Hey, Jess here. Remember last week when I said I was going to try the Great Courses Plus class on botany? I have, and it's so good. I'm learning about the language of botany, and I'm learning about how plants are named like people, and I'm learning all kinds of cool words like monocot and dicot and eudicot. I didn't know any of these words. I'm learning them from Professor Catherine Clyer. She is teaching a class called The Language of Botany. I have it on my phone, and I'm listening to just the audio right now, but there's video too. You can choose. It's really great. If you would like to try out the Great Courses Plus and learn a little something this week that maybe you never even thought about learning before, you can go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting and you can get an entire month of unlimited access for free. thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting. Go learn some stuff. It's so much fun.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, trying to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Welcome to the hashtag AmWriting podcast, usually with KJ and Serena and Jess. Today, just with Jess. We are having a snowstorm today, and KJ is rescuing Serena from being snowed in at her house, and so I am conducting this interview on my own. The hashtag AmWriting podcast is a podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, memoirs, book proposals, queries, scripts, humor books, all kinds of fun stuff. But most of all, it is the podcast about sitting down and getting the work done. And I am Jess Leahy. I am your sole host today. I am the author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. And I am a writer at lots of places, currently including Airmail, sometimes The Washington Post, occasionally The New York Times. And we have a guest today. Oh, and I also, by the way, have a book coming out on April 6th, which if I didn't mention that, my publicist would be really, really mad at me. The Addiction Inoculation will be out on April 6th. Go pre-order it because pre-orders matter. We have a guest today. We have a guest that I am thrilled to have on the show to talk a little bit because he pitched himself for the podcast. And I want to talk a little bit about pitching today because clearly he's very good at it because he's done lots of different things. Jacob Sager Weinstein. And he is here to talk with us today about a lot of, we've had guests on before to talk about the hustle, the doing lots of different things and how you make that work and how you patch together a writing career and how sometimes a writing career starts out in one place and ends up in a very, very different place. So Jacob, welcome to the program today. Jacob is coming to us from all the way across the ocean. So if you hear any rushing sounds, it's just the waves over the cables in the interwebs that go under the ocean, because I'm sure that's how it still works. Jacob Sager Weinstein is a multi-talented and not just multi-talented, but multifaceted writer who's going to talk here today about the pivot and the hustle. He has worked with some really cool writers. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. He has also written comedy for HBO. He has bylines in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Onion, Self. He's written scripts. He's written humor books for adults, middle grade novels, picture book, and this really cool book that I have sitting here next to me. And as I peruse, glide through middle age, I have to say I could use this. It is How to Remember Everything, Tips and Tricks to Become a Memory Master. And the problem is my short-term memory. It's just terrible now, Jacob. I don't know what to do. Jacob, thank you so much for coming on the show. And again, I wanted to mention just off the bat that you pitched us and you wrote a lovely pitch. And here's why it worked. It was human. It was clearly in your voice. And you talked about the possible things that we could talk about. You did some of my work for me. And clearly pitching has been a part of what you've done. And is that something you just had to learn along the way, or did you have anyone that actually teach you pitching along the way?
Nobody ever sat down and formally taught me pitching. I think that because I've done so many different things, and as you said, had to hustle for so many different things, I think I've developed a skill for it. It helps when the pitch comes out of when I'm pitching to something that I genuinely like. So like I said in my pitch to you, I listen to your podcast. I find it genuinely helpful. I've used some of the things you've suggested in doing the publicity in the run-up to the launch of How to Remember Everything. And it's I think I'm not great at pitching to places I don't know when it's just a generic pitch. But when you've listened to a podcast, when you've read a magazine, when you were actually part of the audience, you know what you like about it. And I think, therefore, you can extrapolate what the other listeners like and, therefore, how you can tap into that.
I mean, I think it's one of those pieces of wisdom that people get, which get all the time as writers, which is, you know, read the magazine before you pitch. And mainly that's a know your audience kind of thing. But you can absolutely pick up beats. You can pick up like inside jokes. You can pick up all of these really valuable things that make you feel familiar to the hosts. Like, oh, yeah, this person would fit in really well with what we're doing. And one of the reasons that KJ and I in particular were so interested in what you do is that you mentioned right off the bat that you had these visions for your writing career, Jacob, these very highbrow visions. You had some very, could you tell us a little bit about your, I'm very, very jealous, by the way, about your very illustrious educators, your professors at Princeton. Who were they?
Yeah, so I had an amazing roster of creative writing teachers as an undergraduate. I studied with Mary Morris, with Russell Banks. I had a class on long-form fiction writing where we worked on novellas that was me, five or six other students, and Toni Morrison sitting in a room talking about our work.
So like five or six people and you with her. It's just, I mean, honestly, Song of Solomon is one of the reasons that I started to fantasize about becoming a writer. Like that book was a turning point in my reading career. I don't know what I would do if I was in the same room with her, let alone if she was looking at my words. But you wrote this beautiful, I believe it was in like the Princeton Alumni Magazine, you wrote about what it was like to be in her class. And you talked about the fact very specifically that she made you feel like a colleague. And I probably would have just fallen over if that had happened to me.
You would think that, but part of that is that part of, I think, truly making someone feel like a colleague is it never felt like a favor. And it was only sort of looking back, almost honestly, decades later, that I was like, oh, you know, probably, like, I'm not close to her level now. Probably as a 20-year-old who was just starting, I was not even in sight of being close to being vaguely within reach of that. And so I think that it really did say a lot more about her and her attitude. And if you've read her books, you know that there is this sort of empathy and just sort of a respect for shared humanity. And I don't know, I think maybe you can be like an actor who pretends to be a nice person and be a jerk. But I think if you're going to be a writer and you don't understand people or connect with people, I think that would come through. So I think it just comes down to, I think she is the person that you would think she is having read her books. Just that sort of genuinely empathetic and connecting kind of person. So I was intimidated before I sat down in the classroom, but after, you know, after a week or two, I was like, oh yeah, I do deserve to be here. Which again, nothing to do with me, but just how welcome she made me feel.
Did you have to submit to get into that class?
You did, yeah. So you know, the fact that she saw something or mm-hmm. in my writing to let me in kept me going for decades of rejections from.
That's pretty cool.
So yeah, it was pretty
amazing. But the story doesn't end there. The story does not end there. Who's the other person you've worked with?
The other person it was called a certificate in creative writing. So basically a mm-hmm. minor in creative writing. And as part of the process for that, my senior thesis was a short story collection. And it was given to Joyce Carol Oates to grade. And in terms of sort of support for my writing, she was the anti-Toni Morrison. She wanted to fail me. My advisor, who was Mary Morris, the author and novelist, I think talked her up to a D-, which let me graduate. And what I remember even more vividly than the grade was, you know, you have to write up a page when you're grading these things. You write up a page of your reaction to it. And the line that I remember that Toni Morrison said about my short story collection, she said, it is a most uneven collection of, quote, short stories, unquote. And it was the
Wait, this was Toni Morrison or Joyce Carol Oates?
Joyce Carol Oates. Yeah, Toni Morrison was very supportive. Joyce Carol Oates is the one who called them, quote, short stories, unquote.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And so that sticks with me 26 years later. Yeah. And to be fair, she was probably not wrong. They weren't great, but...
I had an editor once refer to I submitted something for a children's book, and I believe she called it completely altogether unoriginal. Both the character and the story were altogether unoriginal. So, you know, that haunts me as well. But I don't even have a face to put to that. I think I blanked it out after the fact. So you have these incredible writers that you've been working with, and you come out of Princeton with a very sort of lofty goals for your writing. What kind of writer did you want to be at that point when you graduated?
I wanted to be a writer of literary fiction. I wanted to be sort of, you know, I love Toni Morrison and Gabriel mm-hmm. Garcia Marquez, and wanted to be, you know, that of my generation.
Right.
Which is this incredibly lofty goal, but I guess when you're 21, you have to start thinking of yourself as capable of that to get to wherever you actually do end up getting.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to think a little bit like David Foster Wallace in order to be David Foster Wallace, I suppose. If I read the timeline of your career correctly, your first stop was not the National Book Awards. You did not go straight to the National Book Awards and collect that.
Exactly. Yes. Shockingly, they did not hand that to me when I graduated. I'm outraged. I'm going to write a letter. I ended up going out to Los Angeles to grad school there. And I think with hindsight, I would not have done that had I to do that over again. I think that it was useful that it got me out to LA, where I ended up finding work. But I don't feel like I learned a lot from. I got a mm-hmm. master's degree in writing, mm-hmm. and I do think it's immensely valuable for a writer to get feedback and have workshops, and other writers can give you feedback. But I don't think I needed the formal context mm-hmm. of grad school for that. I think I would have been better.
So you're now in the camp of one of those. Do I need to go get a master's in fine arts in order to be a writer? You would be a no on that one.
I would definitely be a no. I think you might need it if you want to get certain writing adjacent jobs, if you want to be a writing teacher in certain mm-hmm. programs, I can see it would be a useful credential. But if that's not your path, and if you have other writers you know who you can just form casual, informal critique groups with, I think that is a better use of your time and money.
So were you using them? I mean, you were using those as a part of your program, but did you have out in Los Angeles a bunch of writers that you sort of hung with and looked at each other's work with?
I did. It's interesting. And I can't, and this is embarrassing for the author of a book on memory, I can't remember the moment when my ambitions shifted. But
I'll look to see if there's anything I can do to help you with that. I'll look through your book right now. You keep going.
I appreciate that. Okay, great, great. There's little you can do to retrieve an already lost memory, sadly. A lot of memory techniques are preserving them.
Right.
But at some point I decided that instead of being a great, you know, the great novelist of my generation, I was going to be the great filmmaker of my generation. So, you know, still the same, very modest goals.
Right.
And I think it's just you're in LA, it's in the water, you feel like you want to write a screenplay, you want to direct. And so a lot of the writers I was hanging out with in LA were fellow people who wanted to be in TV or film. Mm-hmm. So there was definitely a circle of exchanging scripts, giving each other feedback, and working together in that way.
That would feel, I've never done it. I would think that it would feel really difficult simply because you're in that ocean with those many, 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 many fish who are all trying to get to similar places. So given that sort of, you know, the very dense school of fish you were swimming around with, how did you get your first job? Was that HBO?
So what happened was, because you often start off in TV and film in sort of very low-ranking jobs and move your way up, it can be hard to say what. So my very first job was working for Second City Entertainment, mm-hmm. which was described as the film and TV branch of the Second City Chicago Comedy Troupe.
Gotcha.
What it actually was actually two guys in a room who had licensed the Second City name and were like desperately making phone calls trying to get something going. And I got through a college connection, I got an internship with them. And then, so this was back in 1995 when people were still figuring out how to make money doing stuff on the internet. And Microsoft wanted to do shows on the internet. So they hired Second City to put together a comedy show. I got hired to write for it. And then Dennis Miller got hired to be a celebrity spokesman for Microsoft, and then I met him through that. And so I think, like as often with film and TV, there's this sort of bizarre series of happenstance, and you're just in the right place at the right time. And in this case, the interaction that I think sold Dennis on me was he saw how fast a typist I was, and he was looking for a writer's assistant. And so after all that fancy education and the grand right. aspirations, it's just, I'm just a really good typist. And that was my foot in the door.
That's excellent. So for the aspiring writers out there, just make sure your fingers move really fast. Although, you know, David Sedaris, I think I remember he still two finger types. He hunts and pecks still. So I guess, but then again, David Sedaris.
And also that's why I beat him out for the writer's assistant job.
Oh, there you go. That's a very good yes. reason for that. He also was the one who told us to never put yourself, never ask for anything, just wait for things to come to you. And that doesn't tend to work very well for most people. You have to actually, you know, go out there and try for something. Now, we had Jill Twiss on the show, and she worked for The Daily Show, and she talked about the fact that she had to write material as if, you know, on spec as if she was writing for the show. Was that something that you ended up having to do?
That's exactly right. So as I was doing my writer's assistant's job, so I should explain for anybody who didn't see the show, it was sort of same spirit as The Daily Show or the Last Week Tonight, where it was a weekly show on making fun of current events. And so I had clerical jobs where I would like collect the different stuff that the writers were writing and put it together and give copies to everybody. I do research if there's a specific topic on the show. But while I was doing that, I was also writing my own stuff and submitting it. And I was an assistant for 3 years until I finally sort of made enough of an impression to then move from that onto the writing staff.
Do you remember like the first moment that something you wrote ended up on the show?
I don't mean to put you on the spot like that.
Well, it just, I would think that your words. I know for myself, as a political speech writer, when my words came out of someone else's mouth, it was a really strange experience. Like there's something that I wrote coming out of this 50-year-old male's mouth. It was, and I was what, 24 at the time, or something like that.
Definitely. And I remember the sort of the overall strangeness, but I think because we were doing this half hour of comedy every week and it was such a blur, and this is something that I heard Jill Twiss talk about on the podcast, is that you write so many jokes for yeah. every one that gets on. You're just on this crazy treadmill week after week. So there's a few jokes I remember from those 6 years, but it's all, in some ways, it's right. just sort of like a, yeah, it all sort of blurs together.
The other thing about being a comedy writer, and we talk about this with Wendy Ahrens a lot, and she's been on the show a lot too. She writes for McSweeney's and a couple other places, New Yorker. She talks about the fact that, you know, it's a weird, like for me, I just have to string words together and make them make sense and, you know, get at a certain point. But there's the pressure to be funny is just something that kind of overwhelms me because I can be funny, but it is never because I am, you know, forced into a situation where someone's like, okay, now you got to be funny, or your job depends on you being funny. And that I think would be a really, to add to the pressure of the situation, that would be really tough.
It is, although there's something almost freeing. The fact that you know that most of what you write isn't going to get on frees yeah. you. You figure like if one joke out of 100 is going to get on and you write 90 really bad jokes, that's fine. As long as there's 9 good ones and one good enough to air one, that's all it has to be.
Huh. Okay. So you do that for 3 years? Is that my understanding?
That's right. 3 years as an assistant and then 3 years as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what comes after that? Not the next logical step on the usual ladder for that, because you would think, okay, you hone that craft. You're going to do more with that craft very specifically, this very specific route. You're going to go on to try to be a head writer on some show. And that's not
absolutely.
What
you do. And so it's not. And so there were two things that intersected. And one was that I still, after 6 years on the TV show, still had that ambition of being in film. And so even while I was doing the jokes of the show, I was in my spare time writing spec scripts for feature films. And so that was always an ambition of mine still. And then the other thing was that my then-girlfriends and now wife had followed me to Los Angeles for the 2 years of grad school. And then I got the job and it became 7 years and it was my turn to follow her.
Yeah.
And she had always said, you know, what if I got a job in Europe? Would you follow me there? And of course I say, oh, of course I would. Feeling that's a pretty safe thing to say. So she had always been interested in public transportation policy. And Los Angeles is not the best place in the world for that. But
no,
London
it
is. And she got an offer from Transport for London, which oversees the underground and the buses and the roads here. And so I followed her, and that sort of similar to when she followed me, that was going to be for 2 years. And we're now 18 years into our 2 year stay in London.
So writing for Los Angeles becomes difficult when you're living in London.
That's exactly right. And the good thing about that was that after I made this decision to give up, you know, a really good TV job, I told the head writer I was leaving. And then a week later, the show was canceled. And so I got all the brownie points of giving it up. But actually, I didn't give anything up because the job was going away anyway.
Huh.
I was, so when it was canceled, all the other writers were really upset. And they were like, Jacob, why are you so happy?
There you go. So scripts, what happens with the scripts? Does anything happen with the scripts?
Yeah, so I moved to London. I'm mostly unemployed. I'm continuing to take these spec scripts around. And I managed to get some nibbles. So I sold a pilot for a radio sitcom to the BBC, but it never got made. I sold some scripts. I got hired to do two scripts for, you know, respected European directors. I got hired to do an adaptation of a novel for István Szabó, who got an Oscar for Mephisto, I think was his Oscar. He's, you know, a great Hungarian filmmaker. But that the script that I wrote for him was never made. And then I did a script that Peter Medak, who did The Ruling Class, which is a Peter O'Toole movie, he was attached to. That film was never made.
That would be so painful, I would think. You know, at least, like, I talk about my first book that never got published. Well, at least I was able to, like, chop it up into pieces and sell them as articles. Some of the chapters went out as articles, and I made a little bit of money off of that. But you put so much work into a script, and then if someone options it, someone buys it, it's not getting recycled into anything, I guess, except the experience of learning how to write a script. That would be an incredibly frustrating experience for me.
Yeah, it was very frustrating for me. And I feel like I had friends who were working in the Hollywood system who were also writing scripts that weren't getting made, but they were getting paid millions of dollars to have them not get made. And I was getting, you know, I was not getting that $1 million Hollywood paycheck to write unproduced scripts. And I had friends who were getting paid very little, but whose films were being made into these beautiful films. And I was sort of not really either of those. And then I wrote an animated series, a few episodes of an animated series, which I won't name, but it turned out very badly. And so I felt most of the stuff I'm writing isn't getting made. Most of the stuff I'm writing isn't selling. Most of the stuff I'm selling isn't getting made. And the one thing that gets made really turned out very badly.
Well, and there's so little control there, too. I mean, your words can be fantastic, but whatever visuals are going to go on top of that could be a nightmare. And even if you do write a script that's fantastic, then they'll often, you know, it can still get butchered either through the acting or whatever, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's fun. So do you just leave those things off your resume, or do you keep them on there and say, look, I did write this thing and it did get used?
I think it depends on who you're sending the resume to. Sending it to somebody for TV or film, they would get that. And they would understand that your job is to write it. And if you write something professional enough to get made, your responsibility ends there.
That makes sense.
I might not mention it for other things.
That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. There's a few things that I'm actually really, really interested in, which are your middle grade novels, because there's research involved. And now, can you tell us a little bit about the series? It's two books in the series. This is tell us all about it.
Okay. So at the same time, I was getting frustrated with my screenwriting career, such as it was. We had moved to London. We were trying to have and then did have our first child. I think a lot of writers start thinking about children's books when they have their first kid.
Of course. But as you might recall, I wrote the one that was altogether unoriginal and unimaginative and not creative at all, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I had forgotten that, but I know that for you, those words will be burned in your mind forever.
Exactly.
Because I relate to that completely. Just like uneven collection of short stories are in mine. I was living in London, and I think one of the advantages of moving someplace is that you see it with different eyes than if you grew up there. So to me, London just seemed like this very strange and magical city. And I remember there was one time we took a walk along the Thames, specifically the embankment, which is this gorgeous part of London. And I was sort of doing a self-guided walking tour, and I learned that the reason this beautiful romantic part of London was built was to house sewer pipes. That's the only reason it existed. And it just started me thinking that surely there must be some sort of more magical and beautiful explanation other than sewer pipes. And it led me down this road of coming up with this elaborate magical backstory where the whole sewage project in Victorian London is a cover for these incredibly powerful magical rivers that run through London. And that became my first middle grade novel, which is Hyacinth and the Secrets Beneath.
I love that concept. And the covers are adorable. You can check out, if you want to take a look at his the books, they're at his website, jacobsagerweinstein.com. And they are, I love everything about them. I'm going to definitely grab some and read them because I haven't read them yet. But that's such a great premise. So then you get to do research, which is, of course, where my ears prick up. And I'm like, ooh, history stuff. And I love the concept. So how did that work for you?
So it was great. So the research part was a blast. I just have, I'm looking over to my left here. I'm talking to you from my office. I still have two shelves full of books on London history.
Yeah.
And it honestly felt a bit like cheating because I would read this amazing true fact from London history and I would maybe change it a little bit to make it, you know, something to do with a magical story rather than historical reality. But it did not take much changing. And so,
yeah. You
know, the world building was actually pretty easy. I did find one thing that I found very, very challenging coming from screenwriting was I had spent years training myself to do what you have to do as a screenwriter, which is focus on the external. Because when you write a script, you're only writing the things that people can see and hear. So my first draft of the novel had nothing interior about it. You never really got to see Hyacinth's thoughts or feelings. It was all exterior. And I showed it to a friend of mine who was a published children's book writer, and she suggested that I put it into the first person. And clearly you can do third person novels that get into a character's head, but she correctly saw that I couldn't at that point, and that putting it into first person would force me to really get into her head.
Now, you hadn't sold these ahead of time, obviously, since they're novels, right? So you were writing these, you know, just sort of, luckily having someone to give you that reflection is so important.
Yes, absolutely. And it took me, I think from the time I started writing it to the time it came out, it was about 10 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
And probably through about 6 years of that, I was sending it out and getting rejected. And I would send it out and it would get rejected, and then I would rewrite it. If I got feedback, I'd rewrite based on the feedback, or if just having gotten more experience, I could see more flaws in it.
When you say you were sending it out, were you sending it to agents or were you shopping it yourself to editors?
I was doing both. I was mainly focusing on agents.
Okay.
I joined the SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators.
Excellent.
Which I recommend anybody interested in children's books. Yeah.
They're fantastic.
Absolutely. And through them, I would sometimes make direct contact with editors and pitch it to them, but never with any luck. But it wasn't really until I got an agent that I managed to get it sold.
Excellent. And did you sell it as a two-book deal or did you sell it as just one?
I sold it as a three-book deal.
Oh.
And then they saw, then it didn't, yeah, this it didn't sell well enough, sadly, to justify the third one. And I to this day, I feel bad because I ended, when I wrote the second book, I thought there would be a third. So I ended it on a cliffhanger.
Oh.
And every once in a while, I get an email from some parent saying, my kid wants to know what happens next. When is the third book coming out? And I do want to write and self-publish that third book at some point, just because I feel guilty about those kids who are waiting to find out how it ends.
You should listen to the episode with Sarah Stewart Taylor, where she talks about the fact that she published the two with illustrator Catherine Roy. She published the first two books with McSweeney's, actually, with their they had a publishing imprint, and it went under, and so they had to figure out what they were going to do with this last book, because it's really hard to sell one book at the end of a series, which they finally managed to do, and it got out there, but there were a lot of kids very impatiently waiting for that last installment of the story. So I say more power to you, and you should give it a shot. If you ever want to talk to Sarah Stewart Taylor, we can connect to the two of you so that you could talk to her about her experience with that. But think of the kids, Jacob. Think of the children. I really hope that, you know, at the very least, you write a letter to that kid who wrote you to say, you know, I need to know how it ends, because I would go bonkers if a book didn't ever show up and tell me how the whole thing ends. So I think you should go for it. So I assume you got the agent, the agent sold those books, and have you stuck with that same agent, even though now we're in a situation, we've talked in the past about the fact that, so KJ and I, our agent is Lori Abkemeyer, but KJ had to get a different agent for her fiction, and you've done a bunch of different things, because you've done stuff for adults, you've done the middle grade stuff, a picture book, and then this book about memory, and a lot of agents tend to specialize, so have you stuck with the same agent, have you had to change people, how did all that work?
So I realize my career has sort of spun out in so many different directions. I skipped a few things. So I had, when I was working for TV, I had a TV agent. After I moved to London, before I wrote my kids' books, I ended up writing a couple of humor books for grown-ups. Mm-hmm. Just a friend of mine from college said, I have this idea for books. You want to write it with me? And we wrote it. We got an agent. And he was great, but he just didn't do children's books. Mm-hmm. And so with his blessings, I started looking for a separate agent. The children's book agent who sold Hyacinth, who I'm still with, is Amy Joan Paquette. And she is fantastic. And she does specialize, but she specializes in books for young people. So she sold my picture books. She sold my middle grade novels. And How to Remember Everything is actually aimed at kids. And I think that grown-ups and middle-aged people like us can benefit from it. What I found is that, I always had a really horrible memory when I was a kid. And it was only when I was a grown-up that I learned that there's all these techniques that somebody should have taught me as a kid, but nobody ever did. Because all these memory books seem to be for grown-ups. So I wrote this book to sort of fit that missing piece in the market.
Okay, so if you... Now, knowing what you know and living where you live and having written what you've written, what's your vision now for where do you go from here? What's your vision of like the perfect career and what you want? And what's your big picture, Jacob?
The nice thing is, so I feel like for a long time in my career, even when things were externally going well, I was seeing what I was doing as a stepping stone to something else.
Right.
So when I had this job writing for a TV comedy show, which lots of people would kill for, in my mind, the good thing about it was that it would help me become a screenwriter.
Right.
And so I feel like with the kids' books right now, for the first time, I feel like I'm really happy with what I'm doing at the moment, that I don't see them as a stepping board to something else. I think that they're inherently fun to do and satisfying and worthwhile. So I would very happily keep doing this. So although having said that, The publisher who did How to Remember Everything asked me to do some grown-up books, so I'm doing those. And then I'm going to go back to, I want to write another middle grade novel, because I've been working on the memory book and other projects, and it's been a while since I've been in that world of coming up with a world from scratch and the rules of the magic and who are the kids who go into it. So I'm very eager to get back to that. So that is sort of my 2021 goal, is to write that next middle grade novel.
Well, and the cool thing I think about getting to write a lot of different things is I think you do have to try out what works and what doesn't work. I mean, for me, it's a lot harder. I'm not saying I can't do it, and I hope I do get the chance to sort of break through and see that I can. But fiction is really hard. It is a grind for me, whereas the nonfiction stuff just kind of flows. And so I love the fact that, and you know, for me, I've never had a hankering to write a script, but lots and lots of people have. But how can you know if that's something that you want to do unless you go ahead and actually do it? So if nothing else, there's this fantastic situation where you've sort of gotten to do a lot of different things to hone down exactly what it is you love to do. And the middle grade is, and it's really easy to forget that middle grade hasn't existed for that long. I mean, it was like there were books for kids and books for adults, and books for kids were either picture books or sort of YA, and there wasn't a lot in the middle there. So all of a sudden now it's an incredibly fertile category. There's so much great content in the middle grade section, and it's starting to get its own. Oh, and I've got the pug yelling at me. There's so much there now, and I think there's such a wealth of talent happening in that category that I think it's really rich. It's a really, and you have to really know how to talk to kids at that age level too, and they're pretty special. So as most people know, I'm a sucker for that age group. So all right, so we have to take a quick break for a sponsor, and we will be right back.
Hey writers, KJ here. This episode of Hashtag MWriting is proudly sponsored by Author Accelerator. Author Accelerator is a book coaching program that gives writers feedback, accountability, and support so they can finish their books and finish them strong. It's for you if you're launching a new project and want this one to be the one that gets you there, or if you're midway and lost, or if you're sitting on a pile of pages that still seem to need something. Fiction and nonfiction writers can find the help they need at Author Accelerator. Visit authoraccelerator.com/amwriting for free tools and to explore their coaching services.
And we're back, and we get to talk about what we've been reading. And I have been reading some weird stuff lately, but do you want to go first with what you've been reading?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, this ties into what you were just saying before about sort of the development of middle grade as its own thing. One of my projects over the past few months has been to go back and reread everything Beverly Cleary ever wrote in chronological order.
What a cool task.
Yes. And I think, I mean, I consider her one of the great novelists of the 20th century. Like, I rank her up there with Garcia Marquez and Toni Morrison. So it's been really fun. And some of the books I've reread recently as a grown up, some I hadn't read since I was a kid, but just to read them again in the order she wrote them and put them in that context and sort of watch her develop as a writer has been really cool.
Well, I think also people forget about like Henry Huggins, and they forget about, you know, a lot of the, there are a bunch of different characters that all come together. It's not just Ramona and Beezus. There's something that I've talked about. I think I've talked about this on the show before. There is a moment in one of the books that to me is just embodies authors that really understand kids. And that's when Ramona's in the car with her parents and she's arguing in the back seat over a ribbon that her teacher has given her. And the parent, the adult, looks back and to stop the argument says, decides to cut the ribbon in half so that each can have half because that'll be fair, right? And Ramona is just incensed because of course that's not fair because her teacher gave her this very precious thing and to cut it in half is to ruin it. And so there is no sharing of this very special thing. And I love that because to an adult, that would make perfect sense. And to a kid, it is a travesty of the most egregious sort. Yeah, I love those moments. She's a genius.
I agree. And that's such a perfect moment because, and I try to remember this as a parent, as well as a children's author, that there's some things that kids and grownups share in common as values, but there's some things that are really important to kids that are really easy for grownups to dismiss.
Yeah.
And you have to remind yourself that the important thing is the value they put on it rather than whatever objective merit you think this piece of ribbon or whatever it is has.
There's some fun moments in reading about cognitive development where you realize, you know, there are certain age groups to it, you know, for whom justice is like so critical. And if, you know, something even smacks slightly of being unfair, you know, it can really derail a kid. And knowing those moments, knowing when that happens in a kid's life is super important. And do you have a favorite Beverly Cleary?
I know it's hard to
ask. So it's like asking me what my favorite Judy Blume is. But do you have a favorite Beverly Cleary?
It is tough. I'm actually trying to rank them as I go. I think Ramona the Brave is my favorite. And this is, you know, what you said about the different stages of a child's development, that Ramona really feels like the age, because she ages as the books go on.
Mm-hmm.
And she really feels like the age she is in each book. And so to me, Ramona the Brave is the one where she really sort of she's not a grown-up in that by any stretch of the imagination, but she sort of becomes maybe a big kid instead of a little kid. And to see that development from essentially a toddler to a big kid, it's a masterpiece to me. I think it's amazing.
Yeah. I think also the book's, and tell me if I'm wrong, but in there, doesn't Beezus explain how to spell secretary as someone who can keep secrets?
I think that's a spelling hint.
I think that's a spelling hint that Beezus gets or gives Ramona. And I've remembered that my entire life. And they're just little things there. You know, the magic of Beverly Cleary are these moments like when Ramona plays Brick Factory. And to me, I mean, Ramona playing Brick Factory is just this big chunk of my brain is taken up with the imagination and which was really like Brick Deconstruction Factory, because her whole thing was smashing up bricks. And that was something that I did a lot as a kid, just, you know, smashing things up and making, you know, things out of things. And I don't know, it's magic to me. Absolutely magic. I actually got to read a book that I can talk about now because I've already handed the review in, but I got to review a book that is coming out in January. that people should be on the look for, on the lookout for. If you like natural history, if you like science, if you like space, there is a book by David W. Brown coming out called The Mission. And get this, here's the subtitle. Wait till you hear the subtitle. The book is The Mission, or : How a Disciple of Carl Sagan, an ex-motocross racer, a Texas Tea Party congressman, the world's worst typewriter saleswoman, California mountain people, and an anonymous NASA functionary went to war with Mars, survived an insurgency at Saturn, traded blows with Washington, and stole a ride on an Alabama moon rocket to send a space robot to Jupiter in search of the second Garden of Eden at the bottom of an alien ocean inside of an ice world called Europa. That is,
wow.
Okay, so at least you know from the very beginning that there's some balls involved here, right? Because that's a ridiculous subtitle. But at least you know that this is not going to be a simple, straightforward story about all of those things. And what it really is the story of how we ended up creating a mission to Europa, to look at Europa, and which is one of Jupiter's, there's many, many moons, but there are four specific ones, Callisto and Io and Ganymede, and Europa is one of them. And Europa has water oceans. There's a deep layer of ice, a 15-mile thick layer of ice, but underneath that is water. Not only is there water, but there is moving water that appears to plume out from one of the poles periodically, which means the water is, there's a convection system going on underneath all that ice, which means there could be life under that ice. And so there is, and for a long time, you know, Mars was sort of the big target for NASA. And so getting this trip to Europa together, what's now called the Europa Clipper, getting that off the ground, so to speak, what took many, many, many years. And this book is so beautiful. I even tweeted, I said, I am reading a book to review that is just so beautifully written. I'm so excited to be able to tell people about it. And this book by David W. Brown is, it's gorgeous. And I have tons of post-it notes in it, but I have a post-it note on the very first page because the second paragraph, which is long, I'm not going to read it. Basically, I have a bracket around it and the word wow. It's just so beautiful. The second paragraph of this book that goes to page 3 is one of the more beautiful pieces of writing I've read in a while now. So, and David W. Brown writes about science for a lot of different outfits, and his writing is just spectacular. So I cannot wait for people to be able to read this book in January. So anyway.
That sounds amazing.
Thank you, number one, for pitching us. Number two, for reminding me what a great pitch looks like. And number three, for having such a cool, diverse career so that you can help. I mean, I think one of the things that our listeners really like is to hear about the hustle, to hear about how you get from point A to point B and how sometimes that's not at all clear, that the writers we think we want to be sometimes aren't the writers we are while we're getting to the next place. And, you know, if KJ were here, she would say, yeah, I did a lot of journalism, but I always wanted to be a fiction writer. So, Jacob, thank you so, so much. And we're going to need an update if you manage to sell the third Hyacinth book. Is that her name, Hyacinth?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
If you sell the third, please do, because that's a tricky one. I want to hear what happens with that. And I know Sarah Stewart Taylor will want an update because I'm going to text her after this and tell her about it. So.
Oh, very cool.
So thank you so, so much. And if anyone wants to, should people look for you? I gave your website, Jacob Sager Weinstein, and we'll put it in the show notes. But is there anywhere else that you want people to go to look for you?
On social media, I tend to be most active on Twitter. I'm Jacob SW there.
Good man. I like Twitter myself. And we're going to put links to How to Remember Everything. We'll put links to your books and we'll put links to your website. And I'm just so grateful that you're on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
save. Pause. Stop. Stop. Thank you.